recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I am often confined to my room. Darkness is my future. Although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims, we're left to helplessness and nothing else. And speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles. Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities.
North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another nationwide election in the United States, and it will be another drawn-out, bitterly fought, and highly divisive process to determine the final outcome for Congress. Starting with the certainties. The last-minute predictions of a Republican red wave did not materialize. They did, however, take control of at least the House of Representatives, but likely with a much smaller majority than many expected. That means America will have a divided federal government, that President Joe Biden's policymaking will be hobbled for his final 2 years, and that the Democratic Party did suffer a significant national-level defeat.
Hasn't anyone had an education? I'm appalled. We had to take the constitutional test. It is so mean-spirited. Our kids are suffering. I have a 24-year-old. They do not like this country. They do not like what's going on. And their lives are hard. This is the American dream. Now they want to take away Medicare.
In a repeat of 2020, the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote in the state of Georgia to be held on December 6th. That means Americans will have to endure nearly a month of uncertainty.
It's stupid that we would have that, need to take that much time, but part of it's because of a structure of how our, you know, we used to have this done really, you know, just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We had it done in 2 days, at worst case scenario, you know. But in the last three national elections, it's suddenly become an issue of, you know, we've got all this, you know, false voting, fake voting, blah, blah, blah.
Near universal worries about politically related violence didn't happen on election day, but it increasingly seems to be more accurate to call it election month.
Adding to the growing tension is that controversial ex-president Donald Trump is expected to announce on November 15th that he's running for the presidency again. America may soon be arguing over the 2024 election before the 2022 election has been completely decided.
To the chagrin of Democrats and many Republicans, at least 74% of over 250 Trump-backed candidates were victorious, and so-called 2020 election deniers won repeatedly at top state and federal levels. It appears that the factional split within the Republican Party is more cemented than ever, but the unexpected closeness of the congressional vote reveals that the overall split between America's left and right is more narrow, contested, and sharper than ever. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph's Tomb, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aid if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs 3 different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me
event.
Bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Bahrainis have come out and voted in parliamentary elections. Now, this may sound like a very positive development, but not so according to many environment rights groups who have called the environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what is behind this facade that the Bahraini regime is displaying, an election that the powerful Bahraini Shiite cleric, Sheikh al-Assam, has called for a boycott. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Farrell Salnajim, joins us from Toronto. We also have journalist and political analyst Muhammad Ali Araki, who joins us from London.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Muhammad al-Araki in London, taking a look at what rights groups have said about this, describing the parliamentary elections there in the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, being held in an environment of political repression. Tell us what your thoughts are on that, why they're saying that, and of course, then if we take a look at that, wouldn't that make, if you agree, the results to be a sham vote that would be meaningless?
Hello.
Okay, maybe we don't have a connection with you. That question goes to you first, Al-Najim.
Yes. You know, the Bahraini regime has never really been in real connection and real, dialogue with its own people, its nation. You know, we've seen the uprising that happened by the Bahraini peaceful protesters, in the early 2000s, and they were asking for reform, essentially, and the Bahraini regime suppressed them and attacked them and imprisoned all the opposition leaders and started attacking all the civilians everywhere. There is no dialogue with this regime because it does not care about the interests of the nation. It does not respect human rights. It does not respect the call for reform. It does not have any way of interacting with its own nation. It's a very suppressive type of regime, and it's also a tribal regime. and it was UK installed as well. And the people that were protesting were really peaceful. Like, we've seen the protest live on TV everywhere. You know, they were in the Pearl Roundabout at that time, asking for change and wanting change. And they attacked the Pearl Roundabout and they destroyed it. And it was a symbol of their revolution for reform. But now they're calling for the downfall of that regime. And unfortunately, we don't see the Western regimes calling for the regime change inside Bahrain, even though the majority of the nation is against the system itself. And they know that it's a suppressive system. They know it has nothing to do with democracy. But obviously, it serves their interest because the Bahraini regime has the fifth fleet of the Navy there for the U.S. And that is, very essential for them to control the region of the Middle East bully other countries in the region there. So the Bahraini regime also has normalized with the Zionist regime. And that's also another point of where the Bahraini nation, on a large scale, is against the Zionist regime. They're with the Palestinian, liberty. They're for the Palestinian human rights. They're for the support of the oppressed people. And we've seen that, throughout the history of Bahrain, the Bahrainis would always go on the streets and shout "Free Palestine" in Arabic and slogans like that, and come out on Al-Quds International Day. So the Bahraini regime really, there is no credibility in these elections at all. And as we've seen, scholars such as Ais al-Qasim, a very honorable man, he said that we should boycott all Bahrainis, that are loyal to Bahrain and the nation, should boycott these elections and make sure that, they show the system and the world that this regime is not recognized by its own nation. And,
right. If we're, Mohammed al-Raqi, if we're looking at what the people are actually saying, these are the Bahrainis now. They are obviously going out to the streets. They've already done that. They protested the process. They announced that they're going to boycott it, many of the Bahrainis. And one of the things that they said about the elections, that it's going to be a sham election. But they said the reason for their boycott is that this will serve the political trajectory of the ruling class, as they stated. How does that happen? How does this election that's taking place would serve the trajectory of the ruling class, as they stated?
The parliament that is in Bahrain, they are not the one to make the final decision. They help those higher up, including the king, in spreading their propaganda. So, and as we have seen in the past years, there used to be support for the Bahraini nation, different types of benefits and things like that. The parliament used to, once upon a time, help them. Now, the only thing we can see is that life situation is becoming worse. There is a lot of abuse, torture on the different Shia individuals across the country. So I believe it was mentioned by human rights groups that it's not a completely democratic election. I want to say that the whole Bahraini regime is not a democratic government, let alone the election that is going there to be a democratic one. And so another thing is that the Bahraini regime does not really care about what the people want. The current elections is a election show. It's a show played by the regime to broadcast a image that, oh yes, we are very democratic. But in reality, no, the Bahraini government is not democratic, and the nation, they do not give importance to what the nation wants. One of the most important things I could refer to now is that the ties they had with the terrorist regime of Israel, they recently made friends. Now, the Bahraini population, majority of them are Shia, and we have even people from the Sunni school of thought who opposed this. They came out to the streets, they did demonstrations, but the Bahraini government did not change. Now, we cannot expect that when this history of crime, this history of barbaric torture and different acts of crime that they have done, we cannot expect for the Bahraini regime to now be democratic all of a sudden overnight, and now for them to want to pay attention to the people of the country and to help them. And one of the most other important things are that there has been a high amount of inflation within the years that have passed. And another thing is that the poverty has risen, including between the Shia people. So the Bahraini government, not them, not their parliament, not the king, none of them are democratic people, and sure. the elections is not democratic at all.
Sure.
And I don't agree with the term that it's not totally democratic. The essence of it does not represent democracy whatsoever.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll get to expand on that a little bit more. Talk about Israel here, and I think you also talked about it for Feroz al-Najim, in terms of the normalization that's taking place. But can you please explain to us what Sheikh Issa Qassem meant? And I'm going to take a quote from him where he said the election means normalization. And he said the election constitutes a test of the populace's awareness. And he explained that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. What does he mean by that? Feroz al-Najim. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Feroz al-Najim.
Yes, well, obviously the collaboration is a very deep collaboration between Al-Khalifa illegitimate regime and the Zionist illegitimate regime. They are giving them a lot of rights inside Bahrain, more than even its own citizens. And they want to satisfy them because they want to be really good slaves, you know, so they can stay in power. This is, one of the proposals from the U.S., if Bahrain really becomes a good slave to the Israelis and satisfies them and secures their interest, and then, you know, the Bahrainis will give it, they will be staying longer into power. So pretty much, if the nation goes out and elects and gives legitimacy to these elections and to this regime, it's pretty much supporting and empowering the relations with the Israeli regime, because we know that the Israeli regime is totally an occupation of Palestine. And it's totally a human rights violator, and it's a totally breaching all international laws. They don't care about anything. And as a principle, as an Arab, as a Muslim, as a human, you'd be against the Israeli regime. And this, historically, I mean, even the Bahraini regime before used to, speak out for the Palestinians somehow, some places, you know what I mean? But now they shamelessly don't have any more shame, unfortunately. And they're supportive of the Israeli regime, and they're not speaking out for the Palestinian rights. So Sheikh Issa Qassem was very precise. He was saying that if you support the Bahraini regime and give it legitimacy in any way by joining these elections, it's giving legitimacy to the Israeli regime and the relations between Bahrain and the Israeli regime. And this will affect in a negative way, for the Bahraini image and for the history of Bahrain and the future of Bahrain. So, he gave a very clear message to the Bahraini people to choose the right side and to boycott the Bahraini regime, and that means to denounce Israel and all its crimes and all these relations between these two people. The nation is against Israel, so they should not go towards these elections in any way.
All right, looking at a report, it's a 61-page report that's titled, "The Court is Satisfied with the Confession. Bahrain Death Sentences Follow Torture and Sham Trials." Mohammed al-Araki, I'd like to then ask you if you have in this report citations being made about how thousands have been jailed. You have opposition leaders that have been jailed and tortured. Of course, the trials that are a sham that took place in a mass trial setting, including torture that took place in jails. How could then the U.S. that has its fifth fleet there, and also the U.K., which opened up its permanent military base back in 2018, not say anything about what's going on there?
So the United States of America and the United Kingdom, they are both governments, that oppressive governments, that have gone and had a big say in the formation of the Bahraini state. Mr. Ian Henderson, who some know him as the Butcher of Bahrain, who was a police officer who he founded, and he taught many people the different barbaric acts of torture in Bahrain. I had a friend who he was arrested in Bahrain, and to my surprise, this friend, he he was tortured, and he mentioned to me that, yeah, it was this person. They introduced himself as that. So the Bahraini government, they suppress any voice that disagrees with them. There are many different political parties, political individuals, who they arrest them, they torture them, revoke their citizenship. Dr. Jalal Fayrouz, Saeed Shahabi, Ayatollah Isa Qasim, the leader of the Bahraini revolution, these are all people who they have sent them out of the country, apart from the different tortures that they have gone through. So the Bahraini government is not looking to give importance, to listen to the words of its nation. They are ethnically cleansing people in the country. Now, you witness that you have different foreigners come into the country and they provide them with citizenship. Majority of the people now at the ballot boxes, the boxes where they go to vote for elections, they are not Bahraini. They have been given citizenship for the regime to paint a picture of, yes, they are democratic. But in reality, that's not the case. I have many friends. There are many people who the act of torture that they do on them is very inhumane. And I wouldn't be surprised. The United Kingdom and the United States of America, they themselves, they were the founders of crime and the founders of torture and these acts of terror. They brought them all into all these acts into Bahrain. So I wouldn't be surprised for the United Kingdom and the United States of America to remain silent when they see these things happening. And the Bahraini government is looking to paint a form of legitimacy for itself. But for the people who go inside the country, or even you talk to the normal people from the nation, you'll realize that, no, that's not the case.
Uh-huh. Well, when Pope visited Bahrain recently, Fir Hasan Najim, November 3rd through the 6th, you had 130 human rights organizations, 130 of them that came out and demanded things like the release of prisoners of conscience to Pope Francis. They asked him to adopt at least an initiative in terms of urging the Bahraini regime to end these types of violations. 130 human rights organizations. Why didn't this get highlighted? Why wasn't there any type of coverage of this? Because we know that, since we're talking about the U.S. and the U.K. that was just mentioned, they're so quick to want to convene a U.N. session when it comes to human rights of different countries. But yet here, you have 130, again, human rights organizations that have mentioned what is going on in Bahrain, but yet nothing of that sort. Why is that?
Because the U.S., the U.K., and a lot of these Western regimes, unfortunately, they're selective on human rights and they're biased. It's just based on their interests and their benefits and their control. So, for instance, in Bahrain, the regime supports and gives them power and lets them have their, navy bases and all this kind of stuff to control the region. So pretty much it's a puppet for them. So they just keep them in power. And they don't speak about the human rights problems there. But then, because Iran supports the Palestinian cause and stands against Israel and the hegemonic powers trying to control the Middle East, so they find any little small issue that happens in Iran, and right ahead they try to exploit it and speak about human rights. So it's all selective. They care. It's an agenda. Right now, all they care about pretty much is the Ukrainian people and destabilizing Iran, because Russia is their enemy at this point, and Iran is their enemy, and this is how it is. They don't care about humanity as a whole, because they would have spoke out about Shireen Abu Akleh when she was killed by the Israeli IDF war criminals. But we didn't see an outrage. We didn't see so many campaigns. We didn't see that all social media was hashtagging her name, and all these politicians were speaking about it. But now, Mahsa Amini, for instance, in Iran, everybody's exploiting it. They're pushing it everywhere, and they're trying to cause destabilization and problems inside Iran. It's a biased system. The mainstream media and these politicians and these governments, it's like they're programmed to a certain way, and they follow a certain narrative and have a certain agenda. And they do not care about humanity. If they did, they would stand up for all humans that are being oppressed anywhere in the world, and they would be working for real justice and not just choosing and picking what kind of humans they want to support and what humans they don't deserve support. So pretty much some humans for them don't deserve support and don't deserve rights and justice. And some humans, they do. So, you know, it's a very, very ugly game. And I think the masks have been revealed slowly, slowly, and they're getting more exposed. And the world is waking up. I think a lot of people in the world are starting to figure out that a lot of these regimes, they're not truly working for world justice and world peace and things like this.
Sure. I do have to mention a name here, and I'd like to get your reaction to it, Muhammad Ali Arabi, and that is Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja. There are many who are inside jails, but he's been there since the year 2011. I mean, he was the architect, from what many are saying, of Bahrain's human rights movements and leader of the protests that happened back in 2011. He was calling for democracy and greater freedom in the Persian Gulf region overall, but, of course, for Bahrain also. When you have these types of leaders that are in jail, along with many others, their voices are not being heard. What vehicle can be used? We know that his daughters are active on the scene, trying to make sure that the voices of Bahrainis are still heard. But there's not much more that we hear about Bahrain. What can be done in order for those voices to be heard?
In order for the voices to be heard, there has to be work with the different organizations, the different people that we have around the world in human rights organizations, to work with them, including different media outlets, to be able to spread the word of the oppressed nation of Bahrain. And this is something that's very important within the Western countries. People need to go, they need to talk to their MPs, they need to talk to their government officials. Now, not expecting the Western governments to come here and change something, but at least they normally would reply, and that reply would be, and it could be used, published on social media. His Eminence Ayatollah Imam Sayyid Ali Husseini al-Khamenei, he has a term talking about a jihad of clarification. Now, this, I believe, with regards to the Bahraini situation, to make the voice of the people heard, it's a duty that if you're a Muslim, to go around anywhere you can through any social media tool that you have, through any different work, any different gatherings that you can hold, to talk about this to people, to expose the true face of the Bahraini regime. So, and then when people start to realize what is actually going on in Bahrain, now no Western government, nobody will be able to put a to close their eyes onto what actually is happening. Conferences need to happen, different gatherings, and these are activities that they are the duty of us if we are a actual human being.
Sure. Final question, Faisal al-Najim. No matter what happens in Bahrain, if there were to be a day where this democratic ambitions are actually becoming a reality, do you agree that that would be stifled and it would be crushed because you have a bridge that connects Bahrain to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and they cannot stand for a Bahrain that represents democracy, because then they would be frightened that that type of stance or approach by people would spread inside the kingdom, which is something that they cannot afford. Is it true, or is it accurate to look at it that way?
Well, this did happen, right? Like, I mean, earlier in the 2000s when the Bahrainis rose up and they were protesting and they got close to, you know, the so-called King Hamad al-Khalifa's palace, they surrounded that, and that's when the Arabian Peninsula forces from UAE and Saudi Arabia crossed, obviously, through that bridge.
Okay.
And they suppressed the people, and they started to, all kind of sectarian attacks against the people of Bahrain. And,
Thank you. I'm sorry, we're fresh out of time. I do apologize. That was Faisal al-Najim talking to us from Toronto, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, and journalist and political analyst Muhammad Ali Araki. Thank you. Spoke to us from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Itawe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces continue their attacks against Palestinians. What is disappointing is the inaction from world community and the so-called defenders of human rights. In this regard, we have provided views from world media websites. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada had this headline, writing, "Why are Israel's cops a strategic partner for EU?" This website noted, "Supporters of the Israeli regime, believe it or not, get one or two things right. The constant claim that their beloved regime cherishes innovation contains a grain of truth. What other oppressive views Facebook and Twitter as such vital tools for alerting the world to its brutality?" On October 8, the Zionist regime police force effectively admitted that it was subjugating civilians en masse. The force posted photographs on the internet of its officers helping to seal off Shafat's refugee camp near Al-Quds. The Zionist regime presented the suffocation of Shafat as a response to the killing of an Israeli troop. Collective punishment is forbidden under the Geneva Conventions and other instruments of international law. Every time it resorts to collective punishment, the Zionist regime commits a war crime. Avoiding democratic oversight, the European Union has built a formal alliance with the Zionist regime's police. The EU even signed an accord on deepening ties with Israeli regime's police during September, just a few weeks before that force implicitly boasted of committing a war crime in Shafat camp. Though that accord, the Zionist regime can exchange personal data about Palestinians living under occupation with Europol, the EU's police agency. The deal was put together quite swiftly by EU standards. Negotiations aimed at sealing it kicked off in November 2021. Around the same time that the talks opened, the Israeli regime sent a delegation of 30 high-ranking diplomats to Brussels. Among the many officials they met were Laurent Michel from the Migration and Home Affairs Department of the European Commission, the EU's executive. A briefing note prepared for Michel's discussions obtained under Freedom of Information rules states that Israel is a strategic partner country for the EU on security cooperation. The accord signed in September this year follows on from a 2018 working arrangement between the Israeli regime and Europol.
The briefing note for Mashal contends that there should be even stronger cooperation with the Zionist regime. It points out that Europol assists the national authorities of EU governments in identifying cross-border links to organized crime. The Israeli contribution in such cases continues to be of utmost importance, it adds. Since the 2018 arrangement entered into force, the Israeli regime has established a liaison office at Europol's headquarters in The Hague. Such steps offer considerable potential to promote operational contribution, the briefing note says. The 2018 arrangement gives a list of crimes on which the Zionist regime and Europol may work together. They include terrorism and war crimes. It stipulates, too, that information exchange between the two sides must not be collected in obvious violation of human rights. Joke? Was that somebody's idea of a joke? The Zionist regime's police force, as already noted, actively commits war crimes while serving a state that labels all forms of resistance to its systematic violence as terrorism. The Zionist regime systematically uses torture against Palestinians in so-called terrorism investigations, methods which are officially sanctioned and carried out with impunity. The fact that the Zionist regime's police force is based in occupied East Al-Quds should be sufficient to rule out any dealing with it. Despite opposing the Zionist regime's colonization of East Al-Quds on paper, the EU has embraced a police force which plays an integral part in colonization. And what does obvious violation of human rights mean in this context? Does the EU seriously want the Israeli regime to be a little more subtle in the way it subjugates Palestinians? The Zionist regime's police force is not the only despicable body to enjoy a metaphoric message from EU representatives lately. The EU's embassy in Tel Aviv has just teamed up, and not for the first time, with the European Leadership Network, perhaps the most deceptively named outfit in the Zionist regime's army of professional lobbyists. Both the embassy and the European Leadership Network recently hosted a conference for experienced diplomats, officials, and experts. Among the few details published about the event were that it discussed Russia's tension with Ukraine. It is a safe thing that the participants were too polite to denounce the Israeli regime's aggression against Palestinians. Senior figures in the European Leadership Network have raised funds to support that aggression. At one point, the group even counted Michael Herzog, now the Zionist regime's ambassador to the U.S., among its management. He had a significant role in planning a 2002 bombing raid on Gaza, in which 8 children were killed. Don't expect the EU to shun the butchers of Palestinian children. The fabricated regime of Israel, after all, is a strategic partner for the EU.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.